the 7th of October 2023, the Middle East has been caught in a maelstrom of conflict and political upheaval. Amid the turmoil, the Houthis in Yemen have emerged as a significant regional actor, aligned with a broader axis of resistance backed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. During the course of Israel's war with Hamas, the Houthis have launched waves of attacks on international shipping in the Red Sea, causing a shock to one of the world's major trade routes. And they have fired missiles and drones at Israel, invoking solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Now, as the US-Iran war intensifies, the Houthis have declared their support for the Islamic Republic and threatened to bring oil shipments through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal to a complete standstill. Yet few groups in the modern Middle East are as complex or poorly understood. Who are the Houthis and what do they really want? Can they be defeated? Or will they continue to play a major role in the regional landscape for the foreseeable future? I'm Jack Dickens, commissioning editor at Engelsberg Ideas. To answer these questions and to explore Yemen's troubled history, I'm joined by Elizabeth Kendall, one of the world's leading experts on Yemen, the Houthis, and jihadist movements in the Arab world. She is currently mistress of Girton College, Cambridge. Elizabeth, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me back.
So it's now early April. The Houthis have somewhat belatedly entered the conflict between the United States, Israel and Iran by launching a wave of missiles at Israel. Why did it take them so long to intervene in this conflict and why have they done so now?
The Houthis have most likely been keeping their powder dry in this conflict, partly because they're concerned at what they've seen happen to other elements, members of the so-called axis of resistance. And by that, I mean the decimation of Hamas and also of Hezbollah in Lebanon. And of course, quite dramatic strikes on Iran itself, which shows that all of those movements have been infiltrated by intelligence operatives from likely from Israel. But the other reason they'll have hung back is that they probably wanted to play their card at just the right moment. They have been severely degraded. They've been fought a lot over the last 10 to 12 years. They suffered 7 years of airstrikes from the Saudi-led coalition. They then suffered airstrikes from the UK and the US together from 2024 onwards. Then they suffered airstrikes from Israel from July 2024 onwards. And then they also suffered last year in 2025, gosh, must have been 7 weeks of airstrikes from the US. So they're clearly hurting and they probably wanted to wait for the most opportune and most useful moment for them to get on board with the Iran conflict. And given that Iran is under extreme pressure right now, with US troops arriving in the region for a potential ground offensive and with ongoing intensive airstrikes against Iran, this was a time for Iran and its axis to play the Houthi card. It's, in a sense, it's a warning shot across the bows. It's, hang on a second, this could get worse. We're telling you, we're signaling to you, America, we're signaling to you that we still have cards to play, that this conflict could still escalate, that the conflict could get worse, it could expand, and that the trade and economic fallout from this conflict could spiral if we choose to train guns on the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandab as well as on the Strait of Hormuz.
Yes, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the cards that the Houthis have to play now in this conflict. Because much of the analysis so far has focused on the crisis caused to the global oil trade in the Strait of Hormuz. But the Houthis also have the ability to cut off another major global choke point for the economy, which you have described. The Bab el-Mandab Strait, which is obviously between Yemen in the Arabian Peninsula and Djibouti on the east coast of Africa, and it feeds up to the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. Can you explain the threat that the Houthis entering into this war poses to the world economy and also reflect on any other cards that they might be able to play at this moment?
Yes, sure. So The issue for the global economy now is that with Hormuz being all but impassable, a lot of the oil export from Saudi Arabia, for example, has switched now to going through a port on the west coast of Saudi Arabia, a port called Yanbu. And the share of global seaborne crude exports that's going through Yanbu now has quadrupled versus what it was last year. So it's still around about the 10 to 12% mark, but still that's significant when there's a supply shortage. And what's really interesting is that the proportion exported from Yanbu now in very large crude carriers, these are VLCCs, has increased around about six times. These massive ships are too big to get through Suez, so they can't head north after they've been filled with crude. They can't then go through Suez past Egypt and into the Mediterranean because they're too big. So they have to go and exit again via the Bab al-Mandab. And this is that straight, that very narrow area that you just mentioned between Africa and the Arabian Peninsula that the Houthis could potentially target with missiles. So if they were to do that, then it would choke off some of the extra oil supply that's been getting out on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula. And the result of that would be a shock decrease in the oil supply, a dramatic spike in the oil price, and of course, knock-on effects for the global economy. So that's probably the Houthis' main card. But you asked about other cards. They have anti-ship missiles. They don't just need to target these very large crude carriers. They could target trade in general that's going up through the Red Sea corridor towards Suez. They also have very significant drone capacity. And that puts within their reach, gosh, about 2,500 kilometer range, which therefore could target anything from US military bases in the region, US interests in the region, embassies. It could put within range desalination plants of allies of the US. It really has a massive capacity to throw the conflict into a whole nother layer of complexity. And they also have drone boats, which they could use against shipping. Now, one might say, well, hang on a second, they have been severely degraded and it's been much more difficult for Iran to supply them and resupply them over the last 12 months or so. But they can produce domestically. We know that they can produce domestically. We just don't think it's quite as sophisticated. But the thing is, it doesn't matter if what they produce is less sophisticated because their main advantage is that they win in any asymmetric battle because they don't need to be accurate. They don't need to be incredibly sophisticated with what they do. They just need to harass shipping. They just need to keep going. And by doing both of those things, they disrupt the economy, they disrupt trade, and they make America look weak.
And it's worth noting as well that this isn't just pure speculation. The Houthis also have a proof of concept to show, as it were. In 2023 and 2024, when they began striking at commercial vessels and also sending drones and missiles at military vessels, they caused an enormous amount of disruption. Can you just tell us what happened last time round when the Houthis started launching these attacks in the Red Sea?
Yes, the Houthis have got proof of concept. They managed through their launching of missiles, drones, and occasionally drone boats into the Red Sea to severely reduce the amount of traffic that was able to get up the Red Sea corridor towards Suez. So that's a route by which roughly 12% of global seaborne trade traveled until the end of 2023 when the Houthis started their offensive into the Red Sea. And over the course of the next year or two, that trade went down by about 80%. So And of course, insurance premiums went up. And therefore, the costs of getting goods, particularly from Asia to Europe, increased dramatically and had knock-on effects in our own economies here in the West. So they definitely have proof of concept. And the fear is that if they started doing that again, we could at least at the same time that this is happening on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula with the Strait of Hormuz, the impact could be even worse. And it's also worth mentioning here, perhaps, that the Houthis are pretty confident at this point in time because they've been battled by some of the best and most well-supplied and well-financed, well-funded air forces on the planet. They've been battled by Saudi Arabia and its coalition for 7 years. They've been battled by the US, the UK and Israel, and most latterly by the US through its Operation Rough Rider last year. And between March and May last year, the US just persistently bombed and intensely bombed the Houthis, and yet they survived. So for them to come out the other side of such a long campaign waged against it by the United States was a signal to them that the US is not invincible, that they probably are invincible, and most importantly, that they have God on their side.
As well as striking shipping and military ships in the Red Sea, we've also seen the Houthis target America's allies in the Gulf, so Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, who were themselves obviously locked in a conflict with the Houthis during Yemen's civil war not so very long ago. Do you think we're likely to see the Houthis try and play that card as well? Will they try and hit the soft underbelly of America's allies in the region?
Well, that's a very good question. Now, the Houthis can certainly threaten to do that, but I'd be surprised if they do, and that's because they wouldn't want a concerted regional effort against them, because they had just come to a relatively even keel inside the internationalized civil war in Yemen. There's been a truce, more or less, since April 2022 in that war. And by truce, I mean that a kind of cessation of hostilities, of major hostilities between the Houthis and between their opponents in the coalition led by Saudi Arabia. So although there are skirmishes and clashes from time to time, there haven't been big rounds of airstrikes or major battles between Saudi Arabia and the UAE and the Houthis. So they probably don't want to restart that any more than Saudi Arabia and the UAE want to restart a situation where the Houthis are launching drones and missiles against them. So between 2015 and 2022, the Houthis had launched over 1,000 drones and missiles at Saudi Arabia. And since 2022, when that fragile ceasefire came into place, Houthi sophistication and military capability appears to have increased. Now, although their stockpiles have been reduced, that doesn't mean they don't still have some sophisticated weaponry left. So they could easily now be in a position to target in a much more precise and accurate way particular installations, perhaps energy, perhaps desalination, in those Gulf countries. So I guess in short, what I'm saying is that it's in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE and others' interests, and also in Houthi interests, to perhaps pull back from the brink on that. And that's why I think it's far more likely that they would turn, that the Houthis would turn their guns on shipping first.
It's interesting listening to you talk about that, because obviously the Houthis are coming to the aid of their allies in Tehran, but at the same time, the way in which they're doing so seems to be based upon a certain calculation of their own self-interests and what it's in their own self-interest to do and what it is in their own self-interest not to do. Can you just explain a little bit more about the tensions potentially in that relationship between the Houthis and Iran? How closely aligned are they? Should we think of the Houthis as straightforwardly as an Iranian proxy, or are they much more independent than we sometimes appreciate?
Yes, that is a good question. I think quite often the Houthis are mistaken for a direct proxy of Iran, just one lever of Iran. Now, they are a lever of Iran, but they're not a direct proxy in the same way that, say, Hezbollah in Lebanon are a direct proxy of Iran. The Houthis do have some agency of their own. But that said, they are so closely aligned with Iran. And over the course of the last 12 years of the Yemeni civil war, they've become ever closer to Iran. They've been supplied by Iran, they've been trained by Iran. And we know that IRGC commanders, so that's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders from Iran, have worked and are working closely with the Houthis. They are linked together, the Houthis and Iran, by certain ideology, which is rooted in religion. So they are both Shiite branches, although they're not the same branches of Shiism. And their slogans are very similar. The slogan of the Houthis includes the same phrases as the kind of battle cry of Iran, which are the phrases death to America, death to Israel, and a curse on the Jews. So certainly in those terms, they're very much aligned. But the Houthis do also have a sense of their own self-preservation. They've obviously watched other members of the axis of resistance, like Hamas and Hezbollah, be destroyed, all but destroyed, by Israel and America. And they must be very wary of seeing how well infiltrated Iranian leadership is by intelligence. And so they're probably trying to keep themselves to themselves as long as they can and to act in their own best interests. I have to say, though, that there is a point where the Houthi leader did boast about being even bolder than Iran. And it does help the Houthis reputationally to enter this war at some point, this Iran war, because it burnishes their credentials within the axis of resistance. And it shows that they're not just talk with their death to Israel, death to America. They're actually more than just having their fingers on the trigger. They're willing to act. They are the brave heroes, as they would have it, standing up to Zionist American aggression. And they're probably ambitious for slightly more of a leadership role within the axis of resistance. The Houthi leaders' speeches have been warming up for an intervention by starting to frame the Houthi position as defending the Muslim nation, as pitching the current Iran war as a battle for the Muslim nation. So not specifically helping Iran. And that's quite helpful to the Houthis, because supporting Iran and using one's capacity, military capability to help Iran is not as popular inside Yemen as helping Palestine, helping Gaza, or helping Lebanon would be. And this is also why Israel's ongoing offensive in Lebanon actually helps feed into Houthi narratives of a more concerted Zionist US aggression against the Muslim nation in general. So what am I saying? I'm saying that yes, the Houthis are very heavily aligned, very closely aligned with Iran, but that they still have their own agency and they won't do anything too existential for themselves.
So you could say that they don't want to let a good crisis go to waste.
I can't believe how well you summarised what I've just spent 5 minutes saying.
Well, that's very kind of you. We do our best at Engelsberg Ideas, anyway. So I think you've touched upon the somewhat of the history surrounding this relationship with Iran. I just wonder if you could explain a little bit more about the demography and the religious demography of Yemen itself. You said that obviously the Shia Muslims of Yemen are part of the Zaydi tradition, or they're colloquially known as Fivers. What are the core beliefs of Fiver Shiism, and how does their branch of Islam differ from that of the Sunni majority in Yemen and the type of Shia Islam in Iran?
I think it can best be summarized as the fact that these different groups disagree over the succession of the caliphate. So they disagree over issues of leadership and authority. Their core beliefs in the Holy Quran, in the Prophet Muhammad, in Ali, you know, the actual core religious beliefs are, of course, the same. But in terms of leadership and succession and authority, they differ. What the Fivers believe, these are the Zaydi Shiites, which is the group that the Houthis belong to, or the belief group that the Houthis belong to. The reason they're called Fivers is that they differ in whom they believe was the rightful fifth imam of Islam. They believe that the fifth imam was Zayd, who was the son of Ali ibn Hussein, and who was the grandson of Hussein. So Zayd led an uprising against the Umayyad Caliphate in the mid 8th century. And the Zaydis therefore regard him as the rightful fifth imam because he actively rose up against unjust rule. And that's a key requirement for a legitimate imam. Now, where they differ from the Shiites in Iran is that Iranian Shiites are colloquially known as Twelvers. And you might guess from this that they have a different line of succession, that they believe in a line of 12 divinely appointed imams, not just five like the Houthis. They begin in the same place with the appointment of Ali as the first imam, Ali being Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law. But they believe that this line of succession continued all the way through until the 9th century with the Imam Muhammad al-Mahdi, who went into occultation, so into hiding essentially. And they believe that the Mahdi will return at the end of time, whereas the Houthis don't believe that anyone's returning at the end of time. They just think that authority now resides in someone who has the right kind of qualifications and who preferably is a direct descendant of Muhammad through the line of Hussein, who was Muhammad's martyred grandson. And handily, the Houthi family do in fact claim direct descent from Hussein. So they have, in the eyes of the Houthis and the people they control, most of the people they control, a legitimate claim on power. Now, why this is important? It's important because it's going to be very hard to see how any group that believes they have divinely sanctioned right to authority and to practice a supremacist ideology of that kind, it's going to be very hard to see how they could ever form a power-sharing government in Yemen with the Sunni leadership of the South. So it's very hard, therefore, to see how the United Nations roadmap, which is aiming ultimately for some kind of power-sharing government, could possibly work. Because essentially, it would have to share power with a group that is not only supremacist, but also has no problem holding the Red Sea to ransom whenever it doesn't like something. So it's quite hard to see how to solve the domestic Yemeni situation in a way that doesn't keep this war spiraling and cycling for generations to come.
I think you'll get full marks from our listeners for being able to recall all of the complexities of early Islamic history without really taking a beat. So thank you for that. Just thinking about the origins of the Houthi movement itself in the 1990s, you've written before, including in a very excellent article for Engelsberg Ideas, that the Houthis emerged originally as a kind of religious revivalist movement pushing back against Saudi influence. Can you tell us a little bit more about the origins of the Houthis in this period?
Yes. So I'll just go back a little bit further maybe to put this into context, because in the north of what today we call Yemen, there was an imamate of sorts, so a kind of nominally religious state that existed on and off from around about the 9th century right up until the 1960s. And that imamate was toppled in 1962, and a civil war ensued. And that war was between royalists and Republicans. That really ended in the Zaydis, the religious rulers of that imamate, being marginalized politically, economically, religiously. And there were also at that time, and growing over the subsequent decades, attempts by Saudi Arabia at missionary activity of a Salafi Sunni variety in those territories. And you know, as a result, we saw the rise of this movement, this religious revivalist movement, which was known originally as the Believing Youth, and has now become known really as the Houthi movement. And it was formed in the late 1980s by Hussein al-Houthi. He actually was killed when a series of wars began between this Houthi movement that became increasingly militant and the Yemeni government. So Hussein al-Houthi was killed in 2004, and the current leader is his younger brother, Abdul Malik al-Houthi. So religion forms very much a part of their identity politics, although the people who are in the movement now are not all Zaydis by any stretch. They're just part of this because the Houthi movement appealed to them by claiming to stick up for marginalized people in the way that revolutionary movements often do. You can really tell what this movement is about, though, because the clue's in the name. They're actually, the political arm of their movement's actually called Ansar Allah, which means partisans of Allah. So clearly religion is still very much at the heart of their movement.
So they come from this place of marginalization. They're seeking to revive a religious tradition, but they also, in some senses, transcend that in other ways. How and when did the Houthis change from being this sort of revivalist movement and become a more militant force? When did they start taking up arms against the Yemeni government?
The struggle that erupted into war between the Houthis and the Yemeni government came to a head in 2004 when war kicked off as the government under President Ali Abdullah Saleh tried to get the Houthis under control. And that really has, for the last 20 years, been the on-off situation where you can't really put the lid back on the Houthi box. So between 2004 and 2010, there were 6 rounds of war between the Houthis and the Yemeni government, the last one of which Saudi Arabia entered too on behalf of the Yemeni government against the Houthis. And these are all really inconclusive. And the reason that this is such a persistent problem is that the Houthis are so well suited to guerrilla warfare. They hail from these heartlands that are mountainous and really easy to melt away into and hide away. And they were hoping, by the way, with the Arab Spring that hit Yemen in 2011 and 2012, that they might get some kind of settlement that they could live with, that would put an end to their marginalization. And they joined in the National Dialogue Conference, which lasted most of 2013. Yet side deals were done. Again, the Houthis were marginalized. And so ultimately they marched on the capital, Sana'a, in September 2014, and the war began all over again. Now, to many people inside Yemen, that was quite predictable. They always thought that the Houthis would probably return to war, that probably the divisions of Yemen's power, territory and resources would not necessarily be done in the most equitable way. And so we're where we are now. And that war that began again in 2014 is now still technically going, despite an uneasy truce since 2022. And it's very hard to see how any kind of end can be put on that because of this issue that we have, that the Houthis are supremacists, therefore they don't believe in sharing power, and this very awkward arrangement whereby all these different patchwork bits of Yemen over centuries of history, imamates, sultanates, kingdoms, sheikhdoms, fiefdoms, sandwiched together into this great big club sandwich that is Yemen, that doesn't really hang together very well.
So I wonder whether we should think of the Houthis as a tribal or sectarian group, or as a political movement, or are they a combination of all of these things? I think you've hinted at this earlier. How should we think of them as fitting into this very fragmented landscape that you describe?
I think they're all of the above. They have a religious rooting, but they're encompassing a great many more people than are simply religious. They're economically driven, and they definitely seek power and money. And they're politically motivated to control energy resources and power inside Yemen. So it's all of those things mixed up together. And it's hard to know what to do about this because they are now in a position where they control around about 2/3 of Yemen's population. So that's not territorially 2/3 of Yemen, but they're controlling territory in which 2/3 of the population lives. And now that's around about 28 million people. So they have very significant power, manpower behind them. And perhaps even more important is that they're a very youthful population. So if you think about 50%, roughly 50% of Yemen's population is under the age of 18, then you can imagine that half of those, at least in Houthi-run territory, have no memory of anything other than war, pretty much, on and off war. And that means that it's hard for them to desire or hanker after peace because they don't really have any experience of it. And perhaps one other interesting element to bring in here is that they're very well armed as a population. And the youth have been significantly impacted by Houthi propaganda. We often think about the Houthi levers as the military capability they have and the police apparatus that they have to control the population. But by far, their most effective long-term means of control is through propaganda and their online apparatus, their online feeds, and their music, poetry, and song.
They've obviously caused quite a stir on TikTok as well, using that for propaganda purposes. Can you give us a sense of what the Houthi propaganda is like? What sort of language does it use? What sort of mission is it trying to inspire in its followers and its audiences elsewhere?
It's really pumped up. That's a good way of describing it. So, you know, listening, there are lots of different kinds of channels. So if we start with the Yemeni war media channel, they have a specially dedicated war propaganda channel. It has really catchy video clips with sort of throbbing, pumping beats to them where guns are waved and weapons are fired and pictures and images of US warships and planes being blown up are all over it, probably largely AI generated. But it's really, you know, heartbeat inspiring stuff, and you end up it ends up sticking in your mind. Now there's also a news channel called Al Masira, where they also position highly propagandist, good times, victorious stories of how the Houthis are taking on the might of Zionist American aggression and winning. And they always position themselves as Yemen, as the government of Yemen, as the army of Yemen. They always call themselves the Yemeni government, the Yemeni army. And by the way, back in 2023, when they first started launching missiles out at the Red Sea, quite a lot of people bought that. And the story was that, oh, Yemen has declared war on Israel. And of course it wasn't. It was the Houthi government in Yemen had declared a war on Israel. But it's very pervasive, the way that they put the stuff out. And then perhaps, finally, their most effective means are the myriad dozens of social media feeds they have on Telegram, all sorts of different messaging apps that carry zajal. This is a form of poetry and song, very traditional messages where you get these catchy rhymes about how brilliant the Houthis are and how evil America and Israel and its allies are. And also playing on the heartstrings, little video snippets on things like TikTok, where you see pulverized hospitals and screaming children in Gaza, and then cut to the Houthis who are going to, you know, save victims from this. So it's really sophisticated, it's really wide ranging, and it really sticks in your mind.
And do we know whether there's a kind of correspondence between this propaganda and what the Houthis see as their desired endgame in Yemen and in the region? What are they aiming towards? Do we have a sense of that?
It's always hard to have a very good sense of a mission and an endgame when the war started, because the goalposts shift. And we're seeing that with America right now, aren't we, with the Trump administration. What is its endgame in Iran? With regard to the Houthis, well, I think first, when they first went into this in 2014 with their civil war, they wanted power and they wanted money. And the arguments that they used were historic, ethical, and religious. Over the past decade, however, since then, I think they're feeling even more confident. And war has become a way of life. So it's very hard to see them laying down their arms. A lot of people have become very rich on the war economy. And even now, when one might think that they're under great pressure after all of these subsequent air campaigns against them, in fact, they're probably doing fairly well out of the current Iran war. And the reason I say that is that it gives them huge leverage, because no one wants them to enter the war. And Gulf powers like Saudi Arabia especially will not want, at a time when their oil supplies are already finding it tough to reach market, will not want the Houthis to get stuck into the Red Sea. And in doing so, also jeopardize their other revenue streams like tourism, like the realization of their Vision 2030. And so that puts the Houthis in a rather tasty, extractive situation where they might well be trying to negotiate payoffs. And of course, the Houthis also managed a similar kind of protectionist racket on the Red Sea, where some ships were able to pay the Houthis for safe passage via an instrument that the Houthis set up called the Humanitarian Coordination Council, whereby you could pay and then get your ship through without being fired on. So they're actually doing pretty well out of this, and it's not clear that they actually want it to stop necessarily. I mean, this could just carry on at a low level for years.
So what would it take to make the Houthis themselves want this situation to stop? What would it take to bring them to the table and create some kind of grand political bargain in Yemen and the wider Middle East that is acceptable to them as well as to other parties?
Well, you clearly have to offer them something other than, you know, the threat of total defeat, and other than some of the wilder elements that found their way into early United Nations resolutions, like the Houthis have to put down all their weapons, the Houthis have to retreat into their northern strongholds, etc. Very hard to see that ever being realistic. So you'd have to, however, make any gives contingent upon certain behaviours. So, for example, if there were investment in rebuilding the pulverised northern areas of Yemen that are the Houthis' heartlands and giving them access to ports on the Red Sea, it would have to be contingent on certain restrictions around the use of weapons. It would have to be contingent on transparency, on accountability. And that's very hard to see under the current leadership. So before any of this could really happen, I think we'd have to find a way of moving hardliners out and moderates in. I think what we can say is that we can't think about a viable future for these vast geographical areas of Yemen without including the Houthis in some way, because they are part of the fabric of Yemeni society. But we need to find ways of building up moderate voices and sidelining hardliners. And one really good way to start this might be by attempting to dismantle the propaganda operations that they have and to spend more time on that and perhaps prioritise it over some of the more kinetic activities. Because this propaganda and the whole operation around that is what really perpetuates the movement and wins over successive generations of youth. So I guess what I'm saying is that it's going to require some carrot as well as some stick and a bit more thought to what kinds of mechanisms we focus hardest on dismantling.
I wonder if we could possibly turn to the anti-Houthi forces in Yemen as well. You've written previously that the weakness of the anti-Houthi coalition also explains why the Houthis still have so much power within the country. What would it take to empower certain segments of the anti-Houthi coalition? And is that a good idea to start with?
Certainly it's a good idea to help build up and empower the anti-Houthi forces in Yemen, yes. One of the things that they've suffered from most is being disunited and perhaps a bit out of touch also with the populations which they claim to lead. And part of that is that often they reside in Saudi Arabia, not in Yemen itself. But since the beginning of this year, so a couple of months ago, we have seen a move to unite the two major splits, so the two major components of the anti-Houthi coalition. These are the Saudi-supported part, and we could call that the Yemeni government proper, the head of the Presidential Leadership Council and the government, and the UAE-supported part of the anti-Houthi coalition. And these are the Southern Separatists, the Southern Transitional Council, who were part of the overall government. Now, although they were nominally working together, they had different end games in mind and were really operating different leadership structures, different militaries, different groups of forces. It was really a very diffuse and unsatisfactory model for governing those parts of Yemen that were not in Houthi control. Since January, the Southern Transitional Council has been, on paper at least, dissolved. The United Arab Emirates has, on paper at least, pulled out. And there is a concerted effort now to get these two bits of the internationally recognised government working together. New appointees have been put into government, including, finally, some women. And it does look like there's now a path towards a more united and concerted effort to create a viable alternative to the Houthis. So hopefully some positive developments there.
And where does the Houthis' relationship to the Palestinian cause fit into all of this? Because they have obviously on several occasions sent missiles over to Israel, declaring their solidarity with people in Gaza. How should we think about their preoccupation with this particular cause? Is it driven by a genuine sentiment and solidarity, or is it something that's very politically useful to them within Yemen itself?
Oh, I think it's both. I think it's both opportunistic and ideological. On the one hand, the Houthi slogan does include the words death to Israel and a curse on the Jews. So it would make sense for them to stand up for those who are suffering from what they would perceive to be Zionist aggression. And that's also quite a popular cause in Yemen. So it was useful for the Houthis to be able to get on board with pitching themselves as the heroes and defenders of Palestine at a time when their support base in Yemen was flagging after 10 years of war, and when the economy was in a poor state for anyone who wasn't in a top leadership position. Of course, the leaders were getting rich on the back of the war, but ordinary people were suffering. So this gave them something that could make them popular and at the same time could fulfill their ideological slogan. So it definitely worked for the Houthis. It worked for them domestically. It worked for them regionally, where they were seen as heroic defenders of Palestine. And it worked for them internationally because they got massive press coverage out of it and suddenly were catapulted onto the world stage. So we'll expect to see that defense of Palestine continue. I think this is also why their entry into the Iran war now has begun, not by hitting out at the neighbors, not by immediately launching missiles at ships, but by launching missiles at Israel again, because that's much less controversial amongst its domestic audience and its regional neighborhood as well.
So for Western powers and their allies in the region, does resolving the Houthi problem really, in your view, require resolving the Palestinian issue?
I think it would be a huge help. Yes, resolving the Palestinian issue resolves a whole lot of problems in the region, not just the Houthi one, because it's so often the card that's wheeled out as the great justification for whatever it is. Removing that justification shoots holes all through the narratives of groups like the Houthis, who can no longer claim to be defending the oppressed people of Palestine. So yes, it wouldn't solve everything, but it would be a massive help.
And I want to ask you whether you might provide some predictions now in terms of where we will go next. I know that's a hazardous pursuit at this time in human history, but what do you think is the most likely scenario in Yemen and the Red Sea? Are we likely to see the Houthis turning the Bab el-Mandeb Strait into a Hormuz 2.0, if you will?
I'm not going to make any hard and fast prediction, but I think it's a real possibility that the Houthis will try to harass shipping going through the Bab el-Mandeb in order to escalate pressure on America and Israel to pull back from what they're doing in Iran and Lebanon and Palestine. But I think that the Houthis will try to calibrate this in order to ensure that they don't provoke a massive new campaign against them. So we might not have the full fireworks display in the Bab el-Mandeb, but I would expect that if the Houthis do turn their attention there, that it will be a drip feed of drones and missiles, enough to harass shipping, enough to hurt trade circulation, and enough to have an impact on the global economy, but not enough to provoke some kind of attack on them, which might prove existential.
Elizabeth Kendall, thank you very much.
You're so welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.